All right. Welcome back to the Midrash.
So we can study, we can continue our study of Yoma. We are going to begin tonight on 75B1 in the Art Scroll, which is Ayin Hey Amud Bet, 75, second side of the folio. And I am going to remind you of something that we touched on it a little bit about, this idea of the Gemara's unfolding, if you will, narrative, not just commentary on our Mishnah, which talks about the prohibitions of Yom Kippur as being potentially texts that remind us what we are to think about when we engage in our fast on Yom Kippur. And this section is going to really get into this reminder about our relationship to kashrut and food. It's also going to get into a little bit of very explicit discussion about what does it mean to be a human versus being an angel. Now, why is it going to do that? Because there might have been thematically among, you know, the chevra, among the religionists, among Jewish people, a sense that the practices of inui, of affliction of the soul, there might have been a sense that what we were trying to do, if we were putting Yom Kippur into a cosmic kind of religious experience, that they were trying to become a little bit more like the angels. That there's a sense in Yom Kippur practice that we're trying to get to an angelic space, inhabit the space of angels, which, by the way, was not far from their minds when it came to tefillah and prayer practices, when we still do today what we do during the Kedusha, right? We go up on our toes a little bit, keeping our feet together during the Amidah. You know, that may possibly be from this notion that we're very connected to the Malachei HaSharet, Malachei Elyon, the angels on high, the angels above, and that we're doing some of this practice to be a little bit like them. And in the moment that we recognize that we can't be exactly like them, that we're blessed to not exactly be like the angels, even though the more mystic outlook might be, oh, would I be among the hosts of heaven to sing God's praises and exist on such an angelic level in ancient Jewish mysticism, as much as later Kabbalah, particularly in ancient Jewish mysticism, which leads to all kinds of poetry about traveling up to the heavens and being part of that host of heavens, that the minute we remind ourselves we're not like them, that's either a moment where we're disappointed because we simply exist in this kind of bodily state and we see all of what's kind of, even to the point of debase, about corporeal reality, being humans in our bodies with all the functions our bodies do, or we celebrate it as God granted us this life, we know how to then achieve a certain level of holiness in this life as these embodied souls, corporeal as we are, having touched for a moment the possibility of angelic reality, having become aware of angelic reality, but coming back down to earth and knowing that we now have the possibility of being as holy, or deriving sense of what we know holiness to be from the experience of being a little bit more like angels and then coming back down to this earth. And yes, I'm giving you that fullness of how to understand a text that's going to not read exactly like that rational explanation I just gave you about a very mystical potential experience. And that text is the next text in the Gemara that's going to talk a little bit about the meat that's still between their teeth and the whole, again, we're traveling through the desert and they're wanting better food and they have the manna and there's this discussion that the Gemara has, and the discussion is going to get into the comparison between, you know, angelic reality and people who have to reduce themselves by the waist that's the me'ayim, that's within their bowels. And that we function on this down-earth reality as people who are, in a certain way, I think the tone here is, we are like animals left to defecate. Now, I bring that out because they're grappling with this angelic and human existence. And whether the angelic existence or the very human existence, both can have the depth of holiness that we know both Torah wants us to live out and God has implanted within us, and that God grants the world and God grants human beings. Okay? So just let's read the next passage with as much, you know, potential meaning locked in it as I'm making of it, but see how that comes to expression here. And you'll tell me if I'm pushing it too far. Okay, so 75b1, left side of the page, down at the bottom, the Gemara relates what followed the Israelites' demand for meat. Remember, the Israelites want meat. Habasar, odenu ben shineihem. The meat was still between their teeth, and it wasn't chewed. And the wrath of Hashem flared against the people, and Hashem struck a mighty blow against the people, and that was, of course, when the Israelites complained about the manna, and they wanted meat in their lives. And God told Moses that he sees these people aren't really worthy, but he's going to send slav, he's going to send quail, so that they can eat, but ad nauseum, says the note below. Right? So much quail I'm going to give you. Uchativ ad chodesh yamim, and it's written in another verse, they'll eat it until a month of days, meaning so much I'm going to send. Ha, ketzad, how's this? How do we reconcile the conflicting reports of the duration of the consumption of the meat that God provided? Beinonim la'al tarmetu. We have to say that these two verses speak of two groups of people. The average people died immediately. What's a beinoni in our tradition? The person... What's that? A beinoni in our tradition is the person who's not all the way in the book of righteousness, but he's not categorized all the way back over here as a Russia, as an evildoer. It's a status in the middle that allows the rabbis in a philosophical way to say, you have the potential of, yes, expressing what you would first feel your desire as a human being. It might be against God's will. It's a sin. You've missed the mark. It's an avera. You've transgressed. But you have the potential of going either direction. If you're benoni, you're in the middle, the spectrum being between being a tzaddik and being a rasha. See the world in such black and white terms. You could say some traditions carried that out in as black and white a way, especially in today's world of educational materials, in some very, very much black and white communities. It could either be a tzaddik or a rasha, and kind of define the world that way. To see the complexity of personhood, though, was the rabbi's endeavor by creating a category that sits between total righteousness and total evil. You're a Benoni. We're all a Benoni. And as a matter of fact, what's misread often is the kind of conception of a tzaddik and a rasha in the world of Hasidut, in the world of modern Hasidic literature, which is an 18th century phenomenon and forward, because of what the Alta Rebbe, who's the first Rebbe of Lubavitcher Hasidut, really created Hatanya, their main book of outlooks on Jewish possibility in the world, a person's possible relationship with mitzvot, with righteousness in the world, any individual, and they categorize people as Benoni. They categorize people as being in the middle, recognizing that everybody has the potential of growing towards being more a vessel of holiness, more a vessel to be angel-like, and even though you're so human, we know that we have this potential. But anyway, the Midrash comes and says, the average people died immediately, Rishaim, Mitztarefin, and the wicked suffered continuously until a month of days had lapsed, and then they died. So certain people died in the wilderness. Those who really didn't fix their ways, they got it quicker. Those who really were Rashaim, who really complained against God, and who really overdid it, they died in the wilderness. Okay, Gemara continues to elucidate the Slav meat passage, as it says here in our idiomatic translation. On the right-hand column on 75b1. Vayishtachu. The verse states, and they spread out, Vayishtachu, and Amar Reish Lakish, but Reish Lakish says, Al tikre Vayishtachu. Don't read it as Vayishtachu, that they spread out. He reads it as Eila Vayishchatu. Rather, they slaughtered the meat ritually. So from this verse that said God, when God sent all this quail and meat in the desert, instead of just they were spread out, it means that they slaughtered the quail ritually. They slaughtered the birds ritually. Now this is a very popular midrashic hermeneutical move. Don't read it one way. Take a look at the letters, see the possibility that the verb could be different, and I'll read it for you this way. And from that even, we learn laws. And so, we learn the law. Milamed, shenitchayavu sonehen shel Yisrael shchita. This teaches that the enemies of Israel deserved slaughter, and since they deserved it, we ultimately have rights to wage certain wars against certain enemies. But the verse continues, Shatoch, spreading out. And they spread out around the camp. Tan mishmeded Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha. A brayta taught in the name of Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha says, Al tikrei Shatoach. Do not read this word as it is written Shatoach, Ela Shachot, rather, as it were written, Shachot slaughtering, Milamed Sheyiralahem LeYisrael Imaman Davar Shetaun Shchita. And this is where actually what I said before comes into play, that it teaches that an item that requires ritual slaughtering came down for the Israelites along with the manna. What is that item that came down with the manna that needs ritual slaughtering? Birds. The birds. Now, Amar Rabbi. Rabbi said, Uvechimi kana talameid, but do you learn from here that a bird requires shechita? Let's read his question a little bit more adamantly. Vechimi kana talameid? You're going to learn from here that a bird needs shechita? I know, he says, Rabbi, I know that we have the tradition of slaughtering behemoth, of slaughtering cattle, red meat. You're learning from this verse that you're rereading a word that you have to slaughter, ritually slaughter, kosher, make kosher a bird through the proper ritual slaughter. But halo kvar nemar, isn't it already been stated? Vaymater aleihem ka'afar she'er uchachol hayam of kanaf. And he rained upon them meat like dust and winged birds like the sand of the seas. Ah, in the Psalms, I have this episode of the quail being sent down, that's in our chapter Numbers 11 that we're talking about, and these winged birds are there, and I'll use this other verse. V'tanya, it was stated, Rabbi Omer, v'zavachta kasher tziviticha. He wasn't really asking, do I really learn Shechita from there? What he was asking is that the verse you're going to learn from? I have another verse that I learned it from. My tradition is that we learned it from a verse of Psalms. We've had this conversation in the Beit Midrash before. When I can find a Torah verse that proves that I have a mitzvah to do, it's adif. It's preferred than a verse that I have from either prophets or the writings in the Tanakh. However, we've shown time and again that it is possible to actually learn mitzvot from verses outside of Torah. When I really create what's called Midrash Halakha. This is an example of Midrash Halakha, probably extant a long time before the Gemara and the Rebbes of the Gemara start to argue it out, even the Tanaim. Professor Weiss Halivni even supposes that the first kind of Midrash that exists, the first genre of rabbinic literature that gets accepted by the Jewish people, the first way the rabbis assert their kind of management of what the tradition really is based on the holy books that we all relate to. Of course, we relate to them as holy books, the Torah, and other texts that become the Tanakh, the canons in formation throughout the age that the rabbis are rising in their power. But some of the first texts may have been Midrash Halakha. These small nuggets where I don't read the text one way, I read it another way, and therefore I learn a law, or I see the repetitions of don't cook a kid in its mother's milk three times in the Torah, and I learn three distinct, unique laws about kashrut based on those repetitions. And here we're seeing that work out of the genre, and questions by the Tanaim about the sources for some of those laws.
The Koran reads that first half very, very differently than
the article?
Yeah.
Well, how does the Koran read it?
He says that Samehen shall Yisrael is Yisrael itself, and that it's they who deserve shtika for having made the demand for meat.
Ah.
So completely the opposite of what we're there.
Interesting. I'm not sure that that's so far off from the note here. This is a euphemism for the Jewish people that the sages commonly employ when mentioning punishments that could befall the nation. So the euphemism is there, but I don't necessarily read it that way.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm not saying we need to agree with that. I'm just saying very, very different than the lesson you brought.
True. Milamech and it's Tava Moshe ala Aveshet v'ala Kane. And the phrase, as I've commanded you, since it was in that verse, teaches that Moses was orally commanded concerning the esophagus and the trachea. So I just turned the page to 75b2. Rebbe taught, v'zavachta kasher tziviticha, right? And he says this by way of referring back to Shechita, as I, God, have commanded you, which is in Deuteronomy. And that's going to now teach, Milamed shenitztava Moshe al haveshet valakane. The phrase, as I have commanded you, teaches that Moses was orally commanded concerning the esophagus and the trachea. So it says that God said out loud that he's really teaching him about birds. Did it say particularly about birds when that verse was given over in the Torah? No. But what he's suggesting is that that was the moment in God's commanding Moses to teach us Torah that we learned how that we have to ritually slaughter birds. Al rov echad ba'of, and concerning the severing of the greater part of one pipe of a bird, Val rov shnayim bebehema, and the greater parts of both pipes of an animal. So shechita for an animal requires two pipes to be cut through with the great butcher's knife. But for birds, it's a matter of the one pipe. And here we see that it's oral law to Moses that any winged bird comes back to God's command that it has to be slaughtered. And Rebbe has a different way of putting that together than the introductory part of the Braita. Ela ma tamad lomar shatoach. Rather, what does the Torah mean to teach by saying shatoach? Milamed sheyirad lahem mashtechin mashtechin. It teaches that layers and layers of slav fell for the Israelites. So since Rebbe didn't need that first verse, shatoach, to learn the commandment from, and he had it from Psalms and a combination of Deuteronomy, he basically learned something else from the first shatoach reread of the verse that was brought originally in Numbers, and he says, oh, that means it was layers and layers and layers of birds. So what we've got here is the notion, in the midst of the Yom Kippur material, that we have a deep relationship to food and kashrut. Right? If I read this as text to inform me about what my fast is supposed to be about, then part of what I have to concentrate on is understanding that I have an obligation to the laws of Moses as they were discussed on Sinai vis-a-vis not only eating behema that's shechted ritually, but birds. What's so big about birds and the fact that we get the assertion in Yom Kippur of all days, biggest day of the year, but by way of sin and potential fulfilling its vote? What's so big about the birds that I get here? What's the idea coming out here vis-a-vis the essential kosher kitchen of the ancient world? That birds are treated like the cattle, like behemoth, like meat. Right? We know that this was a little bit of a debate. Because in Masechet Chulin, which is the tractate of Talmud that deals with all of the way we shech things and the meals we eat and the meat we eat and the kosher slaughtering we have, there's going to be a little bit of a debate as to whether or not fowl, birds, are really like meat at all. And in the ancient world, it was very obvious to the rabbis that some people even ate fowl and dairy together. And what we have here is the assertion, culturally, that you got to treat your chicken just like you treat your cattle when it comes to shechita and it comes to butchering. And that, of course, makes the argument for really seeing this as the meat side of the kitchen versus any other possibility that you're going to get in another section of Gemara.
I just heard about someone that I thought that they were crazy. Are there still some Jews that will eat cheese with chicken?
Well,
it's allowed.
What?
It's allowed.
No, let's put it this way.
Allowed?
There are those Jews who would say,
do it, but it's allowed.
There are those Jews who would say, no, that's not exactly the way we would say it, I think. It's not permissible by way of Jewish law. It depends on how much you want to go back and be a Jew who asserts a certain opinion mentioned on the books. And we've talked about this in other ways before too, whether it's liturgy or Jewish practice from the ages. When do you assert that a simple mention of Masha Haya, of what that happened before, should become a standard of practice or a possibility for a practice in today's world? When do we hang a hat on a hook that we can find in one text? So I'll give you an example of where that does happen. Okay? How many hours do we wait, typically, in our communities between milk and meat? So the longest I've ever heard is 8. Ashkenazim in general wait 6. Typical to conservative circles, we wait 3.
between meals. It's the distance between meals.
So if you want to get sociological about it, we definitely think about it in terms of the question of what was the amount of time between the world of ancient meals. In the Gemara, they ate a little bit in the morning, and then they had a big meal in the afternoon, and probably nothing towards the evening time. At the time of the Rambam, in those lands, he starts explaining that meals work a little differently around here, but he has the 6 hour standard, so that there was kind of one in the morning and one big one in the afternoon, and if you had anything later, seems like it was a snack. And then you have European sources that come along and say, wait a minute, this isn't working out so much, because the meals that we're seeing go on here, the kind of norms of meals, there's a little bit of a shorter wait between meals. And since it was potentially based on the wait between meals versus the actual science of digestion and those kinds of things, let's renegotiate how many hours we wait. So Moshe Mikusi is the source that we ultimately rely on for the Gimel Sha'ot. He's the one source that we have for 3 hours. And if you study about his place in France, you'd probably then understand why some Ashkenazic Jews would say, no, from a long time ago, I started keeping 3 hours. What's this with six and having to go by the Rambam? And don't we have a law or a way of approaching the Rambam's Mishneh Torah that says, al nifsak al pi Rambam? We don't even create a halachic norm by the way Maimonides decided things in life. So why don't we just go with Moshe Mikusi? Well, the Torah, Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, who creates the legitimate code of law before the Shulchan Aruch becomes the most popular one in the 14th century, goes with the Rambam. And sometimes he will, by the way. It's not just a hard and fast rule that you don't opine like the Rambam. When it comes to between meals, Moshe Mikusi said, it's really happening in a different way here. I'm going to do three. Well, for a long, long time, no one did three. Except maybe a small community who thought Rav Moshe was a good enough or had a read of how to do this. Comes along modern times, comes along the way we kind of do meals, comes along a source that we can look to, and we've opined with that source. Now, does that legitimate every use of a minority opinion or a one-out opinion or a Mishnaic opinion about chicken and cheese? The answer has to be no. Not every individual making chicken parmesan for him or herself will make for a Jewish community. Right? But when a community establishes a norm based on a halachic text that existed within the corpus of responsa literature, let's say, then we could talk about when those newer norms or recovered norms become a good practice for the Jewish community. But I would not say that it's permissible in this case.
What about the Marita?
And I would not say it's permissible from a whole lot of standpoints. And those Jews who are relying on that one peg to hang their hat on when they think about doing it with permission of the sages really are doing something that's a little outside the bounds of how we look at chicken today. There's an entire industry of kosher chicken. There's an entire shechita for chicken and other fowl.
So I had never heard of someone who was kosher having cheese with chicken, but I heard about a group of Sephardim that do have cheese with chicken, and this is what they are referring to. This is where they get these. I never heard of it ever. So I just said, can't be done.
You know, Sephardim or Karaites?
What did you say?
Sephardim or Karaites?
Sephardim. I mean, I just heard about this third hand last week, and you know, they asked me, is this kosher? And I said, I've never heard of it. Can't be. Now you bring it up, and that must be what they...
I've never heard of an opinion from any communal official anywhere that said that it's kosher.
Apparently the people are observant in other ways, so I'm going to find out more about it.
All right.
I thought it was a mistake.
I would be interested to see if there's an opinion in the community.
Yeah,
that would be a radical new notion. Anyway, there we are, encouraging relationship to food and kashrut, also asserting that chicken, they knew from Tarnagol. They didn't know from Turkey. Hope everybody had a good Thanksgiving. They did not know from Turkey. We talked about that on Thanksgiving morning.
New world.
That was a new world bird. The first turkey known by the Jewish community is 16th century. Rabbi Yaakov Lippman and Heller, Yontov Heller, says, not a bird that I'm eating. And his family till this day, by the way, puts chocolate on the plate and will not eat a turkey. They get the plumpest chicken. So some of the butchers in the Lower East Side used to hold out the plumpest chickens for Thanksgiving Day based on some of this history. But what a wonderful history that is for another time.
You know, it's always fun because Jordana has non-Jewish friends and they come over to the house. So, of course, the way they think, you know, we have to explain to them the difference between dairy, meat, and barf.
Oh, right.
So it's always fun to explain to them. They think, we all think, we know that eggs are barf, but you get them in the dairy case. So they figure, number one, how can eggs, they come out of something that we say is meat, be it the egg itself, they associate with being dairy. We have to explain to them there's a third category that they've never heard of before anyway.
Right. Right. Parv is not easy to explain.
Well, just the fact that the egg, in everyone's mind, is not a kosher eater, is a dairy food because of where you get it in the supermarket. So they.
Isn't that funny? Because I would associate it first with Fleischig's.
Well, that's the point.
It came out of a chicken.
Exactly.
But then you have to see...
But eggs aren't meat.
But then you have to say chicken is Fleischig's.
I just realized I never thought about it.
Of course, why would
you?
If it's fertilized, then it's meat.
I've told this story before. I'll do the short form. My favorite parv and egg story is I was a rabbinical student at the UJ, now which is the American Jewish University, in Los Angeles. It's a beautiful little hill in Bel Air between the city and the valley in Los Angeles. Wonderful lectures if you're ever in LA. You can catch a great lecture. It's across from the Skirball Center, their Skirball Museum out there. So lovely. Long story short, I'm the mashgiach in the kitchen. And Pesach is coming. So we're using a huge flamethrower to light up the stainless steel counters and the silverware, because if you make them glow white, you can do what's called libun. You don't need to boil them all. You can really like make them glow. And this was a big... Well, it generated enough heat to send the sprinkler system. And boom, everywhere. I mean, there's this black chemical dust stuff everywhere on an entire kitchen that was kosher for Pesach. Rabbi Elliot Dorf, who's the rector today and a genius with whom Barry Kohler did a whole night on genetics, has to deal with this young student in the kitchen having just set off the entire sprinkler system about the time we're all going home for Pesach. Sirens come wailing, lights are flashing. He comes in and thank God opines, which is true for kashrut and Pesach. He says, don't worry, he's such a mensch. Lo ra'ui la'achilat kelev. Not even a dog would eat this stuff. Just sweep it away. Vacuum it, quick. And I'm standing outside, and I'm seeing the trucks come in. The firefighters are on there looking for the main valve. And mind you, I'm a rabbinical student for a couple of years. I came from years of working in Washington, D.C., for the International Association of Fire Chiefs. So now I'm going to really demonstrate my know-how and wisdom with the fire service, because I rode jump seat and I was with the sprinkler companies and I did advocacy for the equipment, what have you. And I'm going to tell them the main valve is on the left of the building. I saw the fire map, because God knows, like, we had to go home. So I get them to the sprinkler, and I get these folks to the main valve, because if you turn the main valve off of the sprinkler system, and then I run outside, and I see the battalion chief, and he's got he looks like the firefighter. He looks like the battalion chief. Big mustache, and and he comes up to me, and I'm looking like a rabbinical student. Beard, big. So, you a rabbi? Yeah, I mean, ask me anything about the fire service. I'm going to impress you. He says, I got a question for you. My wife's cooking chicken soup for the Seder. Is an egg parv? Here's the battalion chief who wants to know if an egg is parv. I say, that's the question you wanted to ask me? So I tell him, oh, yeah, an egg is parv. We had such an argument because she was dropping eggs in chicken soup. And I'm newly married, and this is not something in my family we did. We had matzo balls, but not eggs. And here she was making eggs, which I'd never heard of, by the way, except for that one moment.
Egg drop soup. She's Chinese,
yeah. Yeah, right. I like an egg drop soup. And meanwhile, they sweep it all up. They vacuum it up. The battalion chief says to everybody, I got to get home for a Seder. All the firefighters run. They double time. Rabbi Dorf goes home. I'm last standing with Omar, our amazing Mexican kosher chef from the American Jewish University, who oversees the kitchen, and Pesach begins. That's my parv egg story.
So you had to stop the fire to know this.
So what was the black dust?
That was because of the heat and the grease fires in the kitchen. It was a unique sprinkler system that shoots out this chemical that immediately douses grease fires.
It's like sand.
And it's not water.
It's not water at all. Gotcha. It was in a part of the building where it was set up with this black chemical that comes out in powder form.
Is
that crazy? Thank you for reminding me of that story. Okay. We're going to 75B3. Because now that we've talked about the food we ingest and how we have to make it kosher in order to eat it in a holier way, we're now going to get to that part where we're talking about the very basics of angelic versus human existence. Angelic, to touch on the sacredness of the angelic world and our potential of being above and beyond our humanness, and the very realities of our human existence, our bodily existence, and we'll hear their... we'll hear in the Midrash that they'll get to this discussion of how human beings defecate, how we wind up clearing bowels, and why we are, I don't want to say cursed with that as part of our existence, but I want to ask you, what's the word here? What valence do you get? What are you hearing in terms of the way they're relating to having to deal with that part of our existence, because they're going to bring it forward as, again, part of this discussion of angelic reality versus the world of humanness reality that we're thinking about on Yom Kippur. Bottom part of 75B3's left column, further scriptural descriptions of the manna. Tanu Rabbanan. So we know Yibraita is coming with Tanu Rabbanan. Lechem Abidrim Achalish. In discussing manna, Scripture writes, humans ate abirim bread. Okay? So that's Psalm, it's said that way in Psalms 78:25. What's the meaning of abirim? Lechem abirim. Shemalachei asharet ochlin oto. Bread that the ministering angels eat. So that means, abirim means the strong ones. And the strong ones is another name for angels in certain poetry that exists at the time. Abirim. That's Divrei Rabbi Akiva. Uchshenem l'dvarim lifnei Rabbi Yishmael. But when they said these teachings, this teaching in front of Rabbi Yishmael, Amar lahem, he says to them, Se'u v'imro lo l'akiva. Go out and say to Akiva, Akiva, ta'ita. You made a mistake, Akiva. Do the ministering angels eat bread? They're angels. The halok var ne'mar, but has it already been stated in the Torah? In other words, lechem lo achalti umayim lo shatiti, bread I did not eat and water I didn't drink. And this about Deuteronomy, when Moses goes up and receives Torah on Sinai, and if Moses, when he went up to receive the Torah, didn't eat or drink anything for the days that he went up to receive the Torah, alachat kama v'kama, implying it's even more so that angels on high would not eat anything and not drink anything. Ela, big hermeneutical word in Midrashic text. Rather, you have to understand it like this. Ela, ma'ani mikayem abirim. Rather, what interpretation do I assign to abirim? Lechem shenivla b'matayim v'arba'im u'shmona evarim. It means bread that is absorbed into the 248 limbs of the human body. That is, that it's evarim. I'm translating the word abirim with the knowledge of the root, aleph bet resh, which is the limbs of the body. An ever is limb. Tradition has it that we have 248 limbs.
How do they count the organs rather than limbs?
What?
Organs. Organs.
Organs, limbs.
Limbs are extremities.
You have all kinds of... Right, so you have... These are not just limbs like extremities. These are limbs like as in organs, parts, passages, tubes... However I got there. And it's all over the Gemara. Like in the Daf Yomi we're learning right now, in Makot, we have the wonderful passage, which is kind of the locus of the notion that in the Torah there are 613 mitzvot, and there are 365 negative commandments, al taseh, don't do this, and there are 248 positive commandments, do this, and each of those is assigned to one of the limbs, organs, parts of the body. And that's one of the ways we have the tradition, but there's no real list of what the 248 are. What meaning am I going to assign the verse then? Vayate tihi elechal ozanecha v'yatzata shamachutz, and you shall have a shovel in addition to your weapons. Now, what that means is the Torah commands in the wilderness that the Israelites should what? They should have a shovel in addition to whatever they need otherwise by way of equipment, their weapons. They should have a shovel. What is that shovel for? Sanitation. Sanitation. They knew to bury. Right? You go into the park today, and the ranger makes sure that you have the principle, you know the principle of take out what you bring in, and how to deal with your poop, right? You have to do the scoop. You have to understand how to bury, how to, if it's a place that you can really use an outhouse, they might encourage it or not. These are things that connect to the very, you know, the human family for all time. Since the manna contained no refuse, why was there a need to defecate? This is the implication. Dvarim shetagarei umot haolam mochrin otan lahem. Why did they defecate? Why did they need to defecate? Because they ate food items that peddlers of the nations around them sold them. Oh, what am I supposed to do with that phrase or statement? A, I relate it back to my kashrut discussion. You obviously defecate because you didn't eat the kosher man, the holy food that Kodesh Baruch Hu sent you. To me, that's inherent in the in the phrase, in the statement. Rabbi Elazar ben Prata Omer, but Rabbi Elazar ben Prata is gonna get a little bit clearer about this issue of why we live with this bodily function. Even the items that the peddlers of the nations of the world would sell to them, man mifigan, the manna would enervate and purify so that this food as well did not contain refuse. Ah, so maybe in the wilderness they didn't exactly need to carry shovels. Ela ma'ani mikayim. Ah, no, but let me explain to you. Rather, what meaning do I assign to the verse v'yata tiyelecha alo zanecha? You should have a shovel with your weapons. La'achar shesarchu This pertains to after the Israelites degenerated and complained about the manna, what happened? Since they were complaining, God made sure that there's going to be a consequence. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One Blessed Be, he says, Ani Amarti Yihyu Kamalachei HaSharet, at first I was going to make you like the angels, and you wouldn't have to eat, and you wouldn't have to drink, and you wouldn't have to defecate. Ani Matriach Otam Shalosh Prasaot. And now I'm burdening you with having to walk three parses. Now I'm giving you the commandment, or I'm making your bodies into bodies that will have to deal with excrement. And you'll have to walk the proper distance to get to the place where you can actually do this in some sanitary way. You're going to be, in a certain sense, the matriach verb is what I was referencing before by way of the valence of the passage, right? Matriach really means, like tircha de tziburra in halachic parlance means really burdening the community too much, therefore you should really make sure that you don't have this happen in the context of a minyan. That matriach, I'm going to trouble you with this. I'm going to cause you trouble. I'm going to have you bother with this, could be the lighter read. But it could be a read that I'm really, really now going to put some, you know, what's going to be trouble. And by the way, what's going to be trouble is when a passageway or an opening doesn't exactly work right. And there's going to be an obstruction. Which is why we come up with liturgy and a blessing that recognizes the amazing wonder of the body working correctly. It's at the beginning of every Siddur, right? I thank God for the openings, the passageways, and the fact that my body functions like it does. The Gemara is going to go and kind of debate. Is it such a tircha? Is it so troublesome? Or is it really that much of a punishment even? I think these next two pieces of it will be asking that inherently. But I'm really interested in how you're sensing the read. Dichtiv, it's written like this, the Gemara points out. Vayachanu al Yarden mi beit ha-yeshimot ad Avel ha-shitim. The Israelites camped alongside the Jordan from Beit ha-yeshimot until Avel ha-shitim. Va'ama Rabba Bar-Bar-Achana, and Rabba Bar-Bar-Achana says the following, L'didi chazi li hahu atra, I myself saw that area, v'chavaya talata parse, and it is three parsos squared. V'tana and Abraita taught, Keshed, Nifnin, when they relieve themselves, Ein Nifnin, lo lifnehen, v'lo litzidehen, they neither relieve themselves ahead of them or beside them, but they went back, Eila l'acharehen, they went behind them. And they knew, in a kind of way of creating the sanitary camp that they needed, that they should go three parsas back, or they should have it behind them, and that this way they could march forward and keep the latrine area behind the camp. Now, these are very important considerations, whether you're camping with a small group, or especially if you've got a big group, and you're out in the wilderness. So it sounds like they're at least calculating what they have to do vis-a-vis the bodily functions that we have been either troubled with or otherwise that have been created into our beings, or into our fibers. And to finish it, and then to discuss it a little bit, V'ata nafshenu v'yedesha ein kol. But now our lives are parched. There's nothing, says the verse in Numbers. Amru, they were actually saying, Atid man zeh shetipach b'me'ehem. Eventually this mana will expand in our intestines. Klum yesh yelud isha shemachnis veino motzi. Is there any such thing as a creature born from a woman who takes food in and doesn't excrete? Isn't it simply naturally human to eat and produce waste? So by the end of the passage here, and that's where we're going to stop it before we go to 76, saying, look, but this is human. If I start out that Abirim means the angels on high, and that angelic existence means I don't have to eat and I don't have to drink, and a little bit on Yom Kippur, I neither eat and I neither drink, and I feel a little bit like Moses going up the mountain to get the Torah, Because remember, Yom Kippur is about coming down the Torah again as well. It's the Sinai. It's the second set of tablets. And I really feel like I'm connected to the angels and their way of being. And then I think about my bodily existence as this kind of goes and creates this narrative for me. And I say, oh, you, like, wouldn't it be amazing to be in this existence all year? Wouldn't it be amazing to be angelic, to sit with angels, to be like angels? Ah, but no, I really am. Matriach, God troubled me with this? Or do I think about that a little differently? Or isn't it only human to really have these bodily functions a part of my fiber of creation, and I can yet still achieve some sense of connectivity?
Is there any midrash about Adam and Eve and whether or not they defecated?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I have not done the look at where else in Gemara this topic comes. It's not one of those that I said, let me stop here and go searching. For what, you know, sometimes I do get that bug, as you know. But it's not one I did, but it's a good question.
Because it might indicate whether it's a punishment or part of God's original design.
It's a very interesting question. Can I borrow a pen?
Sure.
Let's go back to that.
Was it like dance along the way? I mean, who did they find?
Right.
The whole thing, the
Nathan's
that
truck.
Isn't the street food, the festival, the truck?
Completely
the
different truck. Concept.
Me too.
Shishlik made of quail.
How did
I ride?
This was really surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, they just go by it like everybody knows.
This
it.
Was real, exactly, and that we should have interaction with the folks there, and buy some food.
They gave us food.
They gave us food. It's incredible.
No, it could be the Egyptians sold them food in the desert.
Could be.
Mm-hmm.
It could be.
Came with them?
No, they were every day. They came and sold them like when you work in a construction site, you have the truck.
So on that tip, I did look for literature. And there is some wonderful literature. One passage I saw in a journal of ancient Greek and Semitic language scrolls that both seem to copy our canonical biblical texts and create, I could call it fan fiction if we thought about the canon being what the canon is of the Tanakh, or I could say that there were other extant texts around the ancient world and say that some of them were in Greek, never in Hebrew, and we're recovering some of those today. And there's one text that talks about the experience of the Israelites in the desert being led by their military rebel leader, Moses, who knows exactly how to navigate through the Midbar, through the desert, and with whom to trade for what they needed to get everything they required vis-a-vis supplies for any of the endeavors the Israelites made. So, interesting as that goes, did they have some of those type of traditions within their midrashic imagination based on other texts? Did they have some type of midrashic imagination about encounters in the Midbar, in the desert, based on their own suppositions? Or is it completely a straw man, a hava amina of sorts, right? Hava amina in the Gemara is when I put something up that I want to knock down. Is it a hava amina of sorts to say, is that why we encountered some type of less than angelic existence and now have these pipes and bowels and excrement because we went outside the bounds and ate food not kasher and we were so desperate for something other than manna, something other than the holy gifts we received, and here's the Havamina, that it was other nations in the desert that gave us this. That's why then the Midrash comes to answer that and says, no, it wasn't that. It was that the Israelites complained, and God would have made them like the ministering angels, but when they complained, even with the quail, God then said, your existence is going to include the defecation and all that earthly, non-angelic existence, right? So it could have just been used in the Midrash itself without having been a real tradition and without having been factual from history.
So technically, are the laws of Kashrut around at this time in the desert? Would they have to follow them?
Well, you could say that what we know from Torah is don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. And you know that the joke goes that that's what it said explicitly three times, and someone says and turns to Moses after he teaches that you can't have milk and meat together ever, you have to have two sets of dishes, and they turn back to Moses and they say, wait a minute, it just says don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. Right, that's the joke. So in the joke is the notion that at some point we expanded kashrut laws to include all of what we consider to be the kashrut laws that we know. The rabbis for sure have them. How far back do they go? Again, Professor Weiss-Halivni, Midrash Halakha could be the earliest strata.
So, but you're holding them responsible right here at this point in time.
But
so
in literature, for sure you're going to hold them responsible. Because that community really is held accountable for Torah the way we understand it pre-rabbinic age into the rabbinic age. There's a wonderful, I think it was his PhD. Well, the question is, did we learn all of those rules at Sinai that go beyond what we have explicitly? Now, we know in Parshat Shemini, for instance, we have a list of kosher birds. We know in Parshat Shemini, we know we have fins and scales for fish. We know in Torah that there are many, many laws and rules that were part of the dietary rules of the ancient Israelites. How far those go to be inclusive of everything that we know in the rabbinic age is the question. Yeah. And I hear it in the question.
If you're going to punish them for not following it.
Yeah. You know, could it have been back to the passage that I coupled with this one? Could it have been that we're making the argument for the bird being considered meat between Masechet Yoma and between Masechet Chulin, because there's some debate still at the rabbinic hour, this rabbinic hour? Yes.
If I can change the subject, but the discussion reminds me of what I was told about among the Haredi, where they wear the belt, where they put
the gartel
around them to separate the parts of their body.
Right.
And I wonder if that goes back to this.
For sure it does.
Principle.
For sure it does. So those who have not seen it, there's a certain kind of belt that certain Hasidic crowd wears during prayer. It's called a gartel. It's double wrap of a black cloth belt, and it has four tassels that are here. They're not tzitzit per se, but it separates from the upper parts of the elyon from the tachton, and the genitalia and lower being the lower parts for all of their sexual overtones and all of their
excretory,
and the potential here of mind and heart and spiritual nature, angelic nature. So there are explicit references to needing at least to engage in that process if you're not going to wear it physically. In early, early manuals of meditation that come around 12th century, 13th century Provence. And already, if you take the mystical notions of defining the upper realms, top three spherot in Jewish mysticism versus the bottom seven, there is, you know, some diagrams where that is looks even like, you know, a bigger belt. And then there's some of the top seven versus the lower three that looks like it's belted off. And discussions of these kinds of separations in the development of the parts of the soul, if you want to internalize it too, there's a sense that you are both animalistic and you're more divine from Elyon, the upper spheres and upper kind of supernal matter. So yeah, you could say that this is the beginning of that echo chamber, right? You could say that a lot of mystical ideas or Hasidic practical mysticism, sometimes you could see Hasidic as being practical mysticism, have their roots very much in rabbinic literature. You could really, really be here and see that coming through.
I just thought it's interesting that they need the physical reminder to emphasize the separation.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, mitzvot are supposed to be lamaaseh in the world of doing, in the world of physicality, because not everyone can be in the higher order control of those kinds of desires either. Right? A lot of that came from temptations, controlling desires that exist within this. More sexual than excretory, but part and parcel of the discussion. Other thoughts?
The concept of they are complaining about going street par sort, which is like 8,000 amot, like 4 miles. So this is the reason why they complain to God, or because it's a concept of, you know, to go 4 miles away just to do what you need to do, you never come back to the camp.
Mm.
So God punished them on that issue. Because I don't see connection to being an angel. I think that they are complaining about the rules of the day.
Could be. That's right. That it's difficult to really keep all this exactly the way it needs to be kept.
To walk 12 miles just to do that?
Yeah. I mean, maybe that was not exact, and they didn't make you count your exact number of steps, but you know, you kind of went to the latrine area.
8,000 amot is one pasta.
Yeah, it's not a small distance.
It's 24,000 per soul just to go.
Amot.
Amot, yeah.
What's an amah, by the way? How do we usually say? We usually say, like, from here.
So it's like 3 feet.
It's like...
It's usually a yard,
3 feet.
From the elbow?
Divided by 3.
No.
So it's 8,000 yards.
That's an amah.
It's an amah.
An amah.
8,000 yards.
I can't imagine it was all the time that long. I think most likely it's the notion of you really do have to take care, though, to make sure it's outside the camp and it's back behind you. And you got to be really careful about all this. Everybody does know. Can you imagine the administration of having a huge number of people wandering?
Yeah, this is the point.
Yeah.
This is completely not logical.
Right, and that...
You need to protect those people. You need an army just to protect them.
And I'm sure there's a couple of people who volunteered to actually show you the way and get everything organized. I'm sure that not everyone said, thank you so much for volunteering. I'm sure there were a few complaints, like, why don't you tell them to go this way? Should make a line, one should go this way, one should go that. This is part of Jewish life.
Astronaut problem. And I think they really did try to work on low-residue diets. You know, could you in fact create a diet that would be completely absorbable?
Nano what?
Well, I mean, that's what they're talking about. I'm just wondering, I don't know how much work has gone into actually trying to construct a diet like that. It would be interesting to know if you could actually do it. But I think that when with the astronauts, I think they actually try to design the diet to minimize the amount of waste. It also reminds me of reading about U-boats and the fact that the U-boats couldn't get rid of their waste until they surfaced again. If you read about how tight they were and how many men had to relieve themselves in one part of the boat, and there's a whole lot about that's problematic about the way how difficult that could be under certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to look at the structure of the New York City sewer system.
Yeah.
It deals with incredible volume.
Yeah, and knowing until the beginning of the 19th century that plumbing was really the major reason for people dying in cities. It's all about lack of sanitation.
Right.
And how many Jews, they give numbers of how many Jews were traveling in the desert and then were talking to them?
Thousands is tradition.
There is still a major problem.
You have to imagine that the notion here that we really could figure out the system somehow is the equal and opposite side of, oh, we're accursed because of this reality we deal with. I mean, that's part of what I think the relationship is to this miracle of existence that our bodies do get rid of the refuse, but plus that we can organize into ways that, regardless of how far it takes us to walk, that we can create systems where we're able to exist and exist with food and drink. And so, I think that to wrap that part up, there's this debate about whether or not bodily existence is a tircha, is troubling to the human being, but there's also the sense that anyone born of a woman, without such a bodily system, and isn't that part of the holiness of our world, and we're not looking to stay up there and be on the mountain and be as part of the Malachei Asharet. We're not there. We're down here. And therefore we will engage in this to remind ourselves of what it could have been, what it was, maybe, perhaps, what God hoped for, but we will see it as holy, these endeavors we make, and we'll use Yom Kippur to achieve that. Let's turn to 76a3 and get to a central question of the Gemara, which is about the Mishnah that we started with. And we're gonna question the Mishnah vis-a-vis the five versus the six afflictions that came in the list. So I'm on 76A3, Ayin Vav Aleph, and I am, if you're using a Vilna Shas, I am at the bottom of the page, six lines down, left side of the wide lines, bottom of the page, sixth wide line, at the Nikudot, Ani Chamisha. Ish? Okay. Ani Chamisha Inuyin Keneged Mi. Now, how do I get the five afflictions that are outlined in the Mishnah? Amar Rav Chista Keneged Chamisha Inuyim Shebetorah. They correspond to the five afflictions, meaning the commandment to afflict oneself on Yom Kippur that's mentioned five times in the Torah itself. And he's going to tell you what those verses are. Uveh, Asor, right? We learned these verses when we first started the class. All the verses in the book of in the book of Leviticus, and we're going to see that we're getting the verses mentioned in short form, and we also have in numbers, right? So it says, Uva Asor, the 10th day of the 7th month you shall afflict yourselves. Va'ach Be'asor, but on the 10th day of the 7th month you shall afflict yourselves. Shabbat Shabbaton, the verse that's about it being a complete rest, and it adds, you should afflict yourselves. V'Shabbat Shabbaton again, and afflict yourselves. V'Hayitalechem, it shall be for you an eternal decree in the 7th month, 10th of the month, afflict yourselves. So since the Torah mentions it five times, we're going to have five different ways of observing the holiday, of afflicting our souls. Gemara says, Hani Chamishahavu. Wait a minute, these are only five verses. V'anan Shitatanan. But we learned in the Mishnah that it's really not five, it's really six. Right? Go back to the Mishnah, count them. Eating, drinking, washing oneself, anointing with oil, wearing the right shoes, and no cohabitation. So we're talking about six. So the Gemara is now saying, what gives? If I only have five verses and I have five mentions of the verb I'm going to base myself on, how do I have six on the list? Ah, so here, the Gemara answers, Shtiya bichlal achilahi. Drinking is included in eating. Ah, so already we have the same argument of the Gemara coming to light. I think we did this once, but who would say that eating is drinking and drinking is eating? Anyone?
Not that they're the same, but it depends on how you define the word eating, because if the word eating really means ingesting, then I think it makes sense that it would include drinking as well.
Okay, so if eating is a broader category of ingesting anything in the body that has potential to keep us alive, so if the next phrase was, well, how do you define eating, your argument might work, right? They're not going to ask, but how do we define eating exactly that way? But they are going to ask, how do we define eating? Is eating drinking?
Their way of looking at things is to break things down rather than to put them together. I mean, they're
We expect that they're going to see them as separate things.
Well, the drinking, to me anyway, is clearly relates to liquid things. Whereas eating is a broader category that includes, you know, we talk about eating soup.
Ah, okay.
And certainly you eat chicken as opposed to drinking chicken, unless maybe Shirley did with some chicken.
They now talk about Soylent Green.
Yeah.
Right, where you can drink your proteins and drink all of your...
Use mastication, chewing as your criterion, then you've got two different...
Right, that's a different criterion.
Right.
Right? Mastication is a whole different criterion than, like, eating soup. By the way, how
depends
many...
Depends on what's in your soup. You may have to chew your soup.
At one school of nutrition, a friend of mine was telling me this because she was majoring in nutrition education. Somebody did a study and was presenting about it. How many people eat yogurt? And how many people eat soup? And chew a little bit while they're doing it. So it tends to not be everyone just drinks or slurps or kind of lets it go. Many people will have to go and masticate while they're eating soup or yogurt. Because by doing so, the theory goes, this person was theorizing, they will have a sense, A, it could be more of fullness, or B, that in the process of ingesting this, they really have this behavior of eating that overtakes any of the kind of...
Natural texture
of the item going in.
I think a lot has to do with protecting your trachea. it's all designed.
In a physiological way?
Yeah, I mean, it's all, you'll do, it reflexly, you'll do whatever you need to do to make sure it doesn't wind up going down in the trachea.
Okay.
So if it's water, you don't need to chew to get things in the right spot to avoid that. But if you're, you know, got a stew or a chili for your soup, you're probably at a greater risk if you're not careful and don't masticate.
I kind of feel like with yogurt, you can make a decision.
Another thing I
don't know.
Swallowing is very complicated.
Yeah, it is.
Swallowing is very complicated.
Let me tell you where the Gemara goes.
Can I just ask a question? Do we have any days where we can drink but not eat? Are there any fast days in that? So whenever you say that you have a fast day or a semi-fast day or whatever, there is always no drinking and no eating included.
The only thing that might be different is that you might have a heter if it's very, very hot somewhere. And people are in danger of really overheating or dehydrating. You might have someone make a hit there on the minor fast days, but not on Tisha B'Av and not on Yom Kippur.
There were other fast days along the way.
Minor fast days, right. And those fast days you wouldn't eat or drink. All right. To Amar Reish Lakish.
Even on those days, if somebody was at risk, they could.
Yeah, we saw that, right? We already saw that. Definitely. You're not doing this to put yourself in mortal danger. Correct. The Amar Reish Lakish. Let's see where Reish Lakish takes it though. After it says drinking's included in eating. Minayin l'shtiyah shehi bichlal achila. How can we derive that drinking is included in eating? Shenemar, because I'll bring you a verse v'achalta l'tnei Hashem elohecha. Notice that the verb is v'achalta there. You ate. Okay? You eat. Masar degancha tiroshcha v'yitzarecha. And you shall eat before Hashem your God, the maser, the tithing of your grain, when you bring it to Jerusalem in your second tithing, your tirosh and your oil. What's tirosh?
Wine.
It is today what we call
wine.
Young wine. Tirosh. It's what we call young wine. Now, the kari le v'achalta, and nevertheless the Torah refers to it, its consumption with the expression, and you shall eat, right? So tirosh, basically we understand that it's either wine, or biblically we used to think young wine, and let me just expand our knowledge about the ancient worlds of wine. So this is a fantastic partner of a couple of books for those interested in the ancient world of wine. So this one's the first one, and it was Ancient Wine, The Search for the Origins of Viniculture, by Patrick McGovern. And then I think this is the second, Uncorking the Past, The Quest for Wine, Beer, and Other Alcoholic Beverages. I can't remember now which one was the first one. Maybe this is the first one. Anyway, it goes further and deeper than you'd ever imagine you could go, based on archaeology and the findings, and their fantastic books about the world of ancient viticulture. So he says, listen to this about the Holy Land's bounty, which may have been something along the lines of what we're going to get into. And there's going to be some discussion here about ancient recipes and rabbinic time recipes that we're going to figure out that we can eat some wine. But in the ancient world, by the Canaanites, the Israelites, Philistines, and other peoples of the Holy Land, little known about the grape varietals and molecular archaeological investigation has barely scratched the surface of what is hidden in ancient pottery fabrics. The intense reddish residue on the interior of a small amphora from Beit Shan, displayed in the Canaan and Ancient Israel exhibit at the University of Pennsylvania Museum, represents a beginning. Analysis by my laboratory showed that the jar had contained, and this is what I wanted to read you, resinated wine. So what does that mean? You could eat wine like porridge. If, in fact, they ate that part that we would normally call the dregs, but it was resonated. And then in other parts, resonated wine becomes somewhat medicinal. And so that a pasty wine is known in and of itself. And maybe that's what they meant by shtia. Because A, it's a liquid that can be like eating. And shtia then naturally can be included in eating. Drinking can naturally be included in eating. Or B, and B, I think that they're relating to drinking, and they're about to relate to more about wine and where it fits into drinking and eating in this next passage in the Gemara, because they knew from using wine on holidays and changing the state of their outlook through wine, yayin yismach levadayin, that wine gladdens the heart of the human being. Like, they wanted to make sure that you knew that achila is out, and if you think that today I mean that you can drink wine and have a fast day where you could drink wine and use it to achieve some kind of spiritual state within your practice, no, it's out. It's out. So that's what I think is kind of going on by including the shtia beyond the five. Because there's some thought that maybe we should, you know, either drink wine as it is, or eat the pasty wine, or eat, you know, or bring wine into the celebration. Meanwhile, the Gemara's discussion continues and says, "Well, you told me this verse, Reish Lakish, where achalta, where eating the wine, is connected to the grain in addition to the young wine, the tirosh." And by the way, it could have been that the tirosh was a little bit of a mix of with the grape skins still in it, and not just pressed. I don't know if Steinfeld has an entry about that. Is there anything on Steinfeld's page about ancient tirosh? No. I was in what's called Ein Kedem, which is a garden in Israel that remakes all the ancient world's horticulture and viniculture and spices, herbs, etc., etc. And they told us that sometimes tirosh, which is the young grape juice or young wine, really, also had within it what that you could chew if you didn't filter it out. Maybe pits, but definitely skins. So that could be. Gemara, though, is going to reject the proof from Reish Lakish, who says, I connect the word eating with grains and with tirosh, with this young wine. Mimai, what evidence do you have to say this? V'dilma de'achle al yedei anigaron. Perhaps the verse refers to where one consumes wine as an ingredient in food, such as through eating what's called anigaron. De'amar Rabba bar Shmuel, and here the sages are going to start to give you recipes. So get ready. The Amar Rabba Bar Shmuel, anigaron is a cooked dish, as Rabba Bar Shmuel described. Anigaron maya de silka. That's a dish made from the water of cooked beets. So it's borscht. Here's the ancient recipe for borscht. Use the water from the cooked beets. And akasigaron maya de chule shilke. And a sigaron is a dish made from the water of all varieties of cooked vegetables. And so what does it mean that we don't drink? That we don't drink those particular, or we don't eat those particular foods that have wine in them either, or soupy liquids. Could this be, by the way, a little tradition about what you don't eat on the ninth day of the month in your special meal where you're considering what to eat? Well, we're not supposed to drink wine at that meal. So maybe it's a leftover tradition, but remember, because we talked about how there's no real place that talks about how you're to make that meal before the day starts and exactly what you're supposed to do. So I'm just surmising, throwing out there, maybe this is one of those traditions that's actually about day 9 and not day 10. Because why am I worried about eating anything on day 10, like anigaron and oxigaron on day 10? Makes no sense. Right? Why would I think I could eat that? Oh, because maybe they say you can eat soup. It's a day where you You can eat soup if you don't have solids in it? Was that what really we were worried about? Well, if you read it for the straightforward sense, yeah, they're worried that you might think, I don't eat meat, but maybe I eat complete liquid soups. Broth of some sort. And I'm going to call that drinking. Gemara presents an alternative proof. Ela Amar Rav Acha Bar Yaakov. Rav Acha Bar Yaakov says the following. Mehacha. It's just derived from here. V'natata kesef b'chol asher ta'ave nafshecha. You shall spend the money for all that your soul desires. B'bakar v'atzon v'yayin v'shechar. For cattle, for flocks, for wine, and for shechar, and you'll eat it there. In other words, if I have Matzah Sheni in my hometown, I'm giving my tithes locally, and I collect up the food and I bring it to Yerushalayim, that's one way to do this, second tithing. But if I sell it by my locality, and I bring my money to Jerusalem to spend, that's another way I can fulfill my commandment to give this particular tithe. And what's included in that fulfillment of my obligation? I can buy cattle, flocks, wine, and shechar. Wine and maybe beer or some kind of mead. Shechar shtiyahu. Now shechar and wine are consumed through drinking. B'kariyei rachmana v'achalta. And the Torah and the text calls that eating again. So I include eating the drinking part. But since you are going to say that drinking is not like eating because it's a little bit of a different action maybe, I'm going to include this to just let you know that when the Torah says v'achalta, and by the way, it didn't say v'shatita, didn't say you drank. It meant eating and what you call drinking.
That's the same terminology. When I say I ate dinner, I am not excluding drinking.
Right. So that is the overall kind of defining eating as imbibe. Ingesting. Ingesting. Exactly. And I think that's what the Gemara is arguing. Especially from the perspective of the psukim, of the verses that use the word bachata. You ate when it came to either your fleshiks or you chose wine or beer. Now from Mimai, what evidence do you have to say this? V'dil mahachanami de'achle al yedei anigaron. Perhaps here too, though, the verse refers to where one consumes wine through eating this kind of borscht that has some wine in it. You've cooked wine in it. So don't think that you are allowed to eat this kind of liquidy thing that has wine and beer, or maybe the verse is simply saying when you ate this wine or beer, it meant that you ate it in the context of what? Having been cooked into some other recipe. And that's what it's referring to. So don't tell me achila, don't tell me eating also includes regular drinking of these things. The achila that these verses have been coming to teach about is eating of these certain kinds of soups or dishes that have wine or beer cooked into them. Shechar katav, the Torah there wrote shechar midi de mishaker, which implies an item that intoxicates, since the verse refers to an intoxicating beverage, and since we know alcohol consumed as an ingredient in food doesn't intoxicate, we then what? We see that drinking is including in the term eating.
There's another word that you haven't talked about, the tarecha, that's oil, included in the list. So it's obvious that it's all generic consumption. It's whatever goes into food, whatever goes into your body in different forms of liquidity.
Yeah.
Because tarecha is oil, and you don't drink oil, you don't eat oil, you use it in...
Yeah. The reason why they want to prove, though, that achila includes drinking in the liquid form
they have all of the others
is so that they can, so so that they have all of the prohibitions in place. And so instead of the six, it's really five, but I'm going to include the shtiya because you might have thought, I didn't mean including drinking when I said to you, don't eat. Therefore, what? By the end of this, we say that indeed achila includes shtiya, includes the regular drinking of a glass of wine or a glass of beer or anything that liquid you want to put into your body, and refer back to those five verses to know that you have five ways of afflicting your soul on Yom Kippur. You could say so.
Use a glass of wine.
Great to be back learning to see you next week.